It's the final push for the candidates duking it out in the primary election. Some people have already voted. Others will wait to cast their votes at the polls tomorrow. Our Wayne Yoshioka joins us for a look at where things stand in the governor's race.
Well, good morning, Catherine.
Hi.
You know, I went on the sign-waving campaigns for the Governor David Ige as well as Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa. And just to get a feel of how their campaigns are going, it seems like Governor Ige's got this real strong core of Hawaii State Teachers Association volunteers and retirees working for him. I went over to Colleen Hanabusa's camp, and she has had bigger rallies, 700, 300 people. But David Ige has been really small coffee hours and stew and rice sort of gatherings. And he's been able, I think, to touch more people face-to-face than Colleen Hanabusa has. Then we look at the amount of spending. They had the late contributions and expenditures report from the Campaign Spending Commission, and I just crunched some numbers, and it looks like Super PAC Be Change Now has spent a total of $66,000 in advertising to oppose David Ige, and in support of Colleen Hanabusa, they've spent $134,000 for a total of more than $200,000 from August 1st to August 6th, infusing a lot of money trying to get those last 75,000 to 100,000 votes left in the precinct polls.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
In 1 week.
Yes. And, you know, they already spent $665,000 in that July time frame. So I don't know how much of an impact the money will have, but it sure is a lot of money.
Right. And when you were in here last week, I know we talked about how you can spend a lot of money and then still lose an election, like we saw with Governor Neil Abercrombie.
Correct. He spent $4.9 million, 10 to 1 over a little-known senator named David Ige. And yet, you know, David Ige came out with 66% of the votes, 157,000 to 73,000, 2 to 1, 2 to 1 he won.
Now, I was at David Ige's headquarters election night, and I was struck by how many people he really knew. They were his, you know, his teachers, and they were just folks that he had known him for all his life and were just very loyal to him.
Correct. And, you know, David Ige grew up in Pearl City when it was basically sugar cane land, and he grew up there. He lived there all of his adult life. So the relationships that he has there, and also having five brothers who also have, you know, lots of in-laws and friends and everything else, he's got a big, big network of really loyal people that are really advocates for his campaign.
Right, and they're going to go out there and vote.
They are going to go out there and vote if they haven't voted already. Now, we've got to get the last people who are going to the precinct polls on Saturday, and you never know until that last vote is cast on who's going to win.
Now, I have to laugh because for the last, I guess, month or so, we've seen candidates position themselves in strategic locations. And, of course, you know, they've just really stepped it up in the last couple of days. So I imagine this afternoon it's going to be crazy out there.
Pandemonium, I think. But, you know, David Ige's got this cadre of retired teachers. And so they can go out at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, reserve the best sign-waving positions, and the people who get off of work come up and they say, wow, it's a whole line of David Ige sign waivers, and that's the advantage I think he has over a lot of the other candidates.
And I know I've done stories where campaigns will actually strategically place themselves where the traffic cameras are.
Ah.
To be able to get that shock of time in. Very, very sneaky. They just, you know, they want to get their reach out in any way they can in these last few days.
You know, nowhere else, I guess, do they do sign waving like we do in Hawaii. And to talk to a candidate, if you don't do it, you have no chance. You have no chance at all in terms of people recognizing you or, you know, even being considered as part of the electoral process if you don't go out there and sign wave, get sunburned, and do the shaka and all that stuff.
There is an art to this. I overheard a candidate complaining that they were out there for 3 hours, and it was I think 2 hours is generally what they like to do, because after 3 hours, I mean, you can get dehydrated, sunburn, like you mentioned.
Correct. And you see the different techniques that they use. You see, like David Ige and Colleen Hanabusa, they'll look you straight in the eye, the driver straight in the eye, and wave to them like they are in the car with them. And you, if you have that intimate connection with the driver, you have an advantage over everybody else who just sort of waves at every car.
So with all this money then being spent in the last few days leading up to the election, I mean, how are we looking at that with these PACs?
You mean the money being spent? Mm-hmm. Well, the greatest example would be Governor Neil Abercrombie, who's outspent David Ige. How much of an impact will that make? I mean, when you think about it, how much of an impact will that have on people who are listening to these negative ads and supportive ads for the last week? I mean, they're just inundated. They're probably, you know, shell-shocked with all the negative campaigning and attack ads that they're hearing. So how much of an impact that will have, that remains to be seen, I guess.
Well, I know we've heard folks say, you know, because of all this spending by these special interest groups, that it's actually going to backfire, that some folks say, you know, I was going to vote for this candidate, but now because of all this influence, I don't think so. I'll check my box for someone else.
And that's going to be reflected in the basically voter turnout. If we have a low voter turnout, we have a very, a voter population that said, you know, I've heard it all. I don't want to hear anymore. I don't want to probably participate in this election. I mean, in 2016, we had 34.8% of all voters showing up, and that was like a real, I mean, that was the worst in the nation. And in 2014, it wasn't much better, 40%, you know, turnout. So it was pretty bad. So we'll see tomorrow.
Well, we don't have the hurricane impacting us like some had feared, at least not in the same way. We thought it was going to be way worse, and that maybe it would prevent voters from actually going to the places to, you know, to vote and cast their ballots.
I don't think that was a real consideration, because there are so many absentee ballots out there. 154,000, 61% of the, you know, of all the voters that were going to vote anyway. So that could have been a consideration, but I don't think that was a real big factor.
Okay. Anything more on the Republican side?
On the Republican side, well, if things go, we'll have a 17% of the votes will be Republican and 80% Democrat. So if that changes, it'll be the first time since statehood that we've had a different balance.
All right. Thanks a lot, Wayne. That was Wayne Yoshioka with the snapshot going into the primary election. You can find more of Wayne's coverage of the political scene on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Paddle Sports on Maui, providing sustainable eco-tours with a dedication to using business for environmental and social change. HawaiianPaddleSports.com.
Did you know that the silicon for Silicon Valley comes from sand in North Carolina, and that sand thieves stole part of a beach in Jamaica? I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, the amazing role sand plays in our lives. Plus, science and dance collide, from choreographing the Higgs boson to saving endangered sea turtles. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Stay tuned. Your backyard quiz is next. Ulehua, In today's backyard quiz, we wanted to observe National S'mores Day for all of you sugar addicts out there. That's right, today's a great excuse to sit around a fire, roast some mallows, and combine it with your favorite graham cracker. And we wanted to take a closer look at one of Hawaii's favorite graham cracker manufacturers, made right here in Hawaii. Diamond Bakery started off as a dream in 1921 between Japanese immigrants, Hidegoro Murai, Kititaru Hiruya, and Matsumaru Muramoto. The three friends had a vision to create Hawaii's first bakery focused on the perfect Hawaiian-made cracker. They named their bakery Diamond after the famous Diamond Head landmark. They all enjoyed baking and spent several hours crafting recipes for the perfect crackers. But it wasn't until 1937, when they hired an experienced baker from the mainland to oversee production, that business really picked up. And we want to know if you know this master baker's name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Chaminade University, Inter Island Solar Supply, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
Starting next month, state health inspectors will be making the rounds of food establishments enforcing a new sanitation requirement. We sat down with Peter Oshiro, chief of the food sanitation branch, to talk about what's in store.
Anybody that has an existing food establishment permit with us, or anybody that's going to apply for a special event permit for any type of carnival or that kind of event, you're going to be required to have what they call a food handler's education certificate now. So this law was actually passed in September of 2017 by the Department of Health, and we've given industry 1 year to comply. And basically, they have to get formal food handler's training certification. So when we do a routine inspection of a facility, we're going to actually check to make sure that while during the normal hours of operation, that there's at least one person available at the food establishment that has formal food handlers education certificates.
It's the basics.
Very basic stuff. Make sure you wash your hands, what temperatures are required for refrigeration, hot holding, what do you cook food products too, in order to kill bacteria. And I guess it also covers sanitizing and cleaning. You have to have proper concentrations in the disinfectant solutions when you sanitize multi-use equipment. So the forks that everybody shares and the cups, those all have to be disinfected properly. And also about food source is really important, where you get your food from. So that's the things that are real basic things that are covered. It's usually about a 90-minute course with an exam at the end. And you can either do it through the Department of Health for free and no charge, or you can go online. There's a number of vendors that will do it for less than $10 to $15. Yeah. It's really very simple to get, and it's designed for entry-level food handlers. So this is really good information for everybody that even does bake sales, those type of things. It's also going to be required for them. So anybody that has even special event permits, if you're going to be selling shave ice at a carnival, you're also going to need that education certificate also. Yeah.
And this is really important because there's a lot of emphasis on food safety.
Right.
From the federal level, state level, and we've had serious cases
yeah.
of either improper handling and cases where I think people have actually died.
Yes, and that's, and all these food illnesses, nearly 99% of them, they're all preventable. So if you apply basic sanitation principles to your food handling, then you will not have any disease transmission. And the main thing is so simple, washing your hands before you handle any food products, making sure that you're in good health also. So any of your food handlers cannot have been ill with any vomiting and diarrhea in the last 72 hours. That's really, really important because most of these foodborne illnesses are gastrointestinal and they're transmitted by poor sanitizing or poor personal hygiene practices. So it's as simple as washing your hands very well and often, and that will prevent a lot of our foodborne illnesses.
And we did have a situation with some bad seafood.
Sure, yes. So one thing about the bad seafood, that was hepatitis A, that Genki sushi occurrence. That was a problem with a food supply that was already contaminated. There was actually nothing that the restaurant could have done short of cooking the food that would have absolutely prevented any hepatitis L transmission. So that's why part of the rule that we passed also requires all food establishment to warn the public that if you're going to consume anything that's raw or undercooked, that you're placing yourself at greater risk for contracting foodborne illnesses. There's nothing you could have done to prevent yourself other than getting a vaccine. So getting vaccinated is very, very important for hepatitis A, especially if you're like me that likes to eat a lot of raw seafood. It never stopped me and it won't stop me in the future. The risk is still very low, but these are things that you can contract and might affect your health long term, especially for the very young and the very old. And one thing good about that case, you know, with all the number of restaurants that were involved and the number of people that were ill, not one Genki employee contracted the hepatitis illness themselves. So that's kind of amazing that they were handling the product all this time. And that actually attests to their back of the house procedures where they were practicing very good personal hygiene practices by making sure they had gloves when they needed and making sure they're washing their hands frequently. So that's really, really indicative that they are doing really good practices where none of their employees contracted it from the product themselves. So that's a really good sign for them. Yeah.
I'm sure you folks are fortifying your efforts to make sure that the food that we eat is
right.
safe.
This is one of the last pieces for myself when I was trying to build, I guess, a base of food safety. So the first thing that we did was change the rule structure so we can have this placarding program. So it's all based around governmental transparency being used to influence industry behavior. So the whole thing is making your inspection reports public. So the placarding system was the first thing to tell the public what the last inspection looked like. And the other thing we did is we put it on a public website. So all of our inspections are in real-time reporting. The day that the inspection is done, it's already up on a public website for the whole world to see. So that has had a big influence on industry behavior. When you can show the owner of the restaurant right after you finish the inspection, you grab their smartphone and you go on the website and say, here, this is what the public sees. It's our unredacted inspections out there. So please correct it quickly. And right now, because of the placarding system, our inspectors find voluntary compliance very, very easy. Everybody self-fixes everything. We don't have to push anymore because of the transparency out there.
And you just recently rolled that out online.
Yes, that started in 2014. So in the past 4 years, the number of critical violations or the yellow placards issued has steadily declined. So we've seen great improvement in the industry where they're now self-policing themselves a lot. And the occurrences of major violations that lead to foodborne illnesses has dropped noticeably. Yeah.
And kudos to your department because I remember 20, 30 years ago,
right.
It wasn't the case. And it was
Sure. Very
difficult to find out what the inspectors found.
Right. When you have manual inspections, currently since 2014, we've conducted, probably about 25,000 inspections or so. And you can imagine trying to leaf through that in a hard copy file, in an old file cabinet where all the establishments are just listed alphabetically. It is very cumbersome. And as far as even data keeping, violation trends, very difficult for the regulatory agency to actually know what's happening out there. So all these computerized systems now gives us at a glance, we can see industry trends, what type of violations are more prevalent than others, and concentrate on those. So, we can see, I guess, after we roll out this mandatory education, we can see if it actually affects our violation rate also. So these are things that we're going to look for. We actually have in place the ability to use metrics to see if our actions actually result in better performance at the industry level.
And just safer food. All
correct.
Right.
And that's what it's all about. Yeah.
Now, if for some reason you start this crackdown in September,
right.
And if a establishment violates it in some way, mm-hmm. then it delays them getting the green placard.
Well, what it is typically they'll probably have a green placard already up. So if a routine inspection, our inspector will walk in and do the inspection. If they don't have a certified food handler, then they're going to have to change that placard to a yellow, because the yellow placard will be issued if you have two or more major violations or one that cannot be corrected on site. So if they cannot get that certificate while the inspection is being done, then the inspectors have to put the yellow placard up and come back the next day to follow up.
The transparency that you've got in place now, I mean, mm-hmm. it really goes a long way in, like you said, self-policing.
It's right,
like
it does.
If you don't want to lose business, you'd better right. step to it.
Right. And, you know, even for them, industry was told, so if you're what they call a high-risk establishment, that means your full-service establishment, you're inspected three times a year. So that's 365 days. So let's say even if you get a yellow placard each of those three times, what the public is going to see for those 3 days out of the 365 is a yellow placard hanging outside your restaurant. It probably will affect your walk-in business. So what happens is the rest of the 362 days, if you do correct it immediately, the public is going to see that green placard. And that's what industry realized, that we're actually giving them a vote of confidence, telling the public that go ahead and eat here 362 days of the year, even though you got dinged three times, that's what the public will actually see. And when industry steps back and says, oh, that's correct, and all we want is rapid voluntary correction of violations, that's the whole goal for this thing.
So it's really a good housekeeping seal.
It is. That's what it is. And they recognize that now, that that helps business, right? To say that the department did come in, inspect this place, and they know there's no longer any, I guess, existing major violations out there. Yeah.
I remember hearing that when you wash your hands,
right.
it's kind of like you sing the happy birthday song.
Right. So, again, what's required is the law says it defines it as 20 seconds. So once you run the water, you have to wet your hands, then add soap, physically scrub your hands for 20 seconds, and then rinse it off and use a disposable paper towel to dry your hands after
you
that.
You can sing happy birthday
correct.
To yourself.
Singing happy birthday twice covers 20 seconds at a normal pace.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
Really thank you, folks, also for helping us get the public messaging out.
That was Peter Oshiro, chief of the state's food sanitation branch, talking about enforcement of new rules that begins next month. To find out more, visit the Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the BIA Big Summer Home Building and Remodeling Show, featuring instructional seminars for building and design today through Sunday at the Blaisdell. BIAHawaii.org.
How can art change and challenge the world? On August 21st at 6 p.m., Shangri-La Artist-in-Residence Bahia Shahab shares her powerful, socially conscious artistic practice and process in a live discussion in HPR's Atherton Studio. Admission is free to A Conversation with Bahia Shahab. Reservations are required at hprtickets.org. Presented by Shangri-La Museum of Islamic Art, Culture, and Design in partnership with HPR.
It's now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Chad Blair joins us with a story about voter turnout. Hi, Chad.
Good morning and happy Aloha Friday.
Happy Aloha Friday. Aren't we glad that this primary is going to be over?
Yes. Not just yet, right? It's tomorrow, and some of us are going to be working through the weekend, probably you as well. But
yeah. Where are you going to be? Are you going to be making the rounds of the election campaign?
For the first time in decades, I will not be at a campaign headquarters or anywhere else. I will be actually at the Civil Beat office.
Ah, shocker. We're not going to see you at Sisebon, huh?
Exactly, or the Japanese Cultural Center, or any number of other places. But yeah, but certainly that's my priority for tomorrow night.
So what's the snapshot on the turnout?
Well, this is a cautionary note here that these numbers are not at all finalized. We're looking at data from the state elections office as of Wednesday, and yesterday was the final day for early voting. So clearly these numbers have probably changed. But the trend thus far is a little bit concerning in just 2 years ago this month, this very week, we had the lowest ever primary turnout, 34.8%. Mm-hmm. And right now, we look like we may actually be somewhat on track to be around that same amount. That's looking at the number of ballots that have come in by mail already or from early walk-in. 2 years ago, there were 156,000. This year, up to that same point, it's about 145,000. So just by percentage-wise, that's about a percentage and a half point lower than what we did 2 years ago so far.
Is that surprising to you? I mean, we've got, you know, good candidates, you know, seasoned candidates in the governor's race, lieutenant governor's race. I mean, lots of people in the lieutenant governor's race for sure. But, you know, you've got good people in there.
You do, and certainly there's been no shortage of attention to the races just from the commercials alone that are airing, all the news coverage. I think the thing that is a little worrisome, and again, who knows, things may change. Remember, Saturday, this is the first time statewide people can still show up and register to vote as well as vote on primary election day. 2 years ago, there were some special locations around the state, so that could change it. People could actually get in, and the polls don't close until 6 p.m., and by the way, you can still get your absentee ballot in as long as it's mailed out by 6 p.m. But the concern is we had been ticking upwards pretty steadily in terms of absentee, meaning people that get the mail-in ballot or people that walk in early. And that was going up even as the turnout numbers were going down. The hope is that the more absentee voters there are, the more people voting from the comfort of their own home, the more people will turn out. Thus far, that doesn't seem to be the case.
Are you hearing anything about what candidates are doing differently this year to get the vote out?
Well, certainly social media, they're using it more and more. Just one example, Colleen Hanabusa, candidate for governor. I've been following her social media feed as well as Governor David Ige. And they're doing exactly what has always worked in the past. They're sign waving. They're meeting with people. They're tweeting out. They're using every opportunity at their disposal. But I think it definitely is the social media that's helping more. But you still got to get out there. I think for a lot of voters, they want to see you actually sign waving. Mm-hmm. And if you're running for a statewide race like the governor and Congresswoman Hanabusa, you're having to fly all over the islands. I think today Governor Ige is going to be sign waving with the HSTA, the teachers union, for example. So aggressive get out the vote efforts, reminding people that it is not too late to vote. You can't do it today, early walk-in, but as I said, tomorrow, what time do the polls open? 7 a.m., something like that? They're open until 6, and they'll even stay open if you're still in line.
That's right. They usually do. We know that.
We do. We know that. We've been there standing with them. Come on already.
Okay. All right. Well, this is the first year that I don't have to actually go to any of those
You and I are celebrating
either.
The same thing.
I know, but then someone said, you know, you just got to come out. So I don't know. Sese Bon is right down the street, Japanese Cultural Center for Hanabusa's not too far away either, but I don't know. Is it good enough for David Copperfield? Maybe it's good enough for David Ige? I don't know.
Play it by ear. But one way or another, we will all be looking forward to, I think, the primary being done. It's going to be pretty dramatic, I have a feeling, and perhaps of an historic nature, too.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was Chad Blair, political and opinion editor at Honolulu Civil Beat, with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. The ubiquitous campaign sign. In some areas, it may seem like they're multiplying. Driving around, we got to wondering about all those signs set up in strategic corners and neighborhoods across the state. Many are plastered on chain-link fence fronting someone's front yard. If you assume the property owner is all good with those political signs, well, you might be wrong. We found out not all candidates and their campaign workers ask permission. I didn't have to go far to find one homeowner, Mr. John Souza, who wanted to vent about it.
I think I counted about 30 signs on your fence. What's up with that?
Every campaign year, man, they come and they put on signs. It was getting carried away by everybody putting like one person sign up, like 8, 10, 12 signs, one person. But
one candidate.
Yeah, one candidate. Then finally I said, you got to make on a level playing field, huh? It's one sign per candidate.
I mean, you have both Ige and Hanabusa, and you've got, you know, you've got players in all the fields.
No particulars, just, you know, even slate for everybody, you know, not favoring nobody, nothing. And even if I was, it's even still yet, you know, you cannot just pick one person and have one person do six signs and everybody else can only put one. Eh? Right. So it's even across the board.
But you think it's gotten out of hand?
Yeah, when you go to sleep at 3 in the morning and you wake up and there's signs with candidates on and they know the rule is one sign and you wake up in the morning and there's six of them. And I put them on Facebook and I tell them, come pick up you guys' rubbish because I don't know who you guys are that I'm put them up.
So some candidates ask and some don't?
Some don't. The ones that they don't and they put up more than one. If they never ask and they... I watch from years doing this. I watch if they did more than, you know, one sign. I watch the following year. I watch when the election is over, if they actually come and take down their sign. If they don't come and take down their sign, the following year, if they don't ask and they try to put them up, I just take them down and throw them away.
Yeah, I guess there's some basic etiquette, I would think. You know, have some aloha for the people whose yards you are using.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, we don't want to look at them every day. Eh? The wind don't come through the yard because of the signs. Eh?
So do you know who you're going to vote for on Saturday?
Honestly, no. But it's getting out of hand.
So you just like to ask them to kukua?
Yeah, you know. Kamala Doa had one person, candidate, came, said she came three times and nobody answered the door. And finally I answered the door one day and then she said that, I got in touch with you. And then she asked to put up her sign. Now, you know, that's good. I mean, you know, if you don't get cars at the house.
Yeah. Appreciate that.
Yeah,
that
most definitely.
Okay.
This must be going around all over, but some people say things, some people don't, yeah. Yeah, I'm a little outspoken, so I say what I feel, yeah.
So got that, candidates, campaign workers, kokua, ask permission, don't get so tantara, kindly remove those signs after the election, please. Mahalo. Here in Honolulu, sewage capacity has been a limiting factor for homes applying for ADUs or accessory dwelling units. That was certainly the case in the Kaneohe region, where 160 people who applied were rejected. But the city says now that upgrades to the Kaneohe Tunnel project is complete, it's encouraging those folks to reapply. Mayor Kirkald was introduced a bill to provide tax breaks to those who build ADUs in an effort to spur development of our housing inventory.
And we put in this ADU bill and it passed, and the council even made it better by providing more incentives to try to get folks to build a second small unit on their property of 800 square feet or less. So it's affordable for rental, and not vacation rental, for rental of 6 months or more. So local families can find a place where their kids could maybe rent and not have to leave for the continent because it's just so unaffordable here. There's about $11,000 incentives for people if you built an ADU. And the good news is that with these bills and these amendments, we now have about 100 and almost 170 of these units built around the island. I tell you, if we built 100,000 ADU units, we would really tackle our affordable housing in a very easy way, where government is not the one buying buildings and building buildings. It's the private sector responding to the market and through regulation and building and addressing our affordable housing challenges. With this significant increase in capacity over on the windward side between Kailua and Kaneohe with this deep gravity flow tunnel, perhaps we could look at those permits that we denied. And so you can see the alignment here of the tunnel. It's an amazing engineering feat, our first of a kind in the state of Hawaii, 400 feet deep, 13 feet in diameter, with a lot of capacity and no longer pumping under pressure. Sustainable, it's energy efficient, moving from Kaneohe down to Kailua. There's a lot of capacity, and permits that we denied maybe could be now, if reapplied, we'd give them the permit for an ADU because there is sewage capacity that wasn't there before. And what this bill basically does is that if you build an ADU, you will get a $60,000 exemption to the value of your property, meaning that you see a tax savings of approximately $210 per year for 5 years. And it ends in 2025. And it's because we want folks to know you don't have a lot of time. You got to get going. You got to build this. We have a crisis here. We want to see more units being built on properties around the island.
Now, the city expects some 4,000 more properties to be available to be tapped for ADUs just in the Kaneohe region. Fishing is a concern around the world and here in Hawaii. A new conservation law just signed by President Trump stands to significantly change the way commercial fishermen in Hawaii and U.S. Pacific territories bring their catch to market. But there's more to the situation than meets the eye. The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty has a story.
Billfish, like swordfish, marlin, and sailfish, are some of the most prized catches in sport fishing. They were so popular with both trophy hunters and commercial operators that by the 1980s, stocks of billfish in the Atlantic had plummeted. That led Congress to ban commercial harvesting of billfish in U.S. Atlantic waters. But billfish are highly migratory and live in deep water, the kind of habitat found in international waters. 15 years after the U.S. ban, billfish stocks worldwide were still declining. Eric Kingma is the International Fisheries Enforcement Coordinator for the Hawaii-based Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, also known as WESPAC.
In 2012, Congress passed and President Obama signed the Billfish Conservation Act of 2012, and it prohibited the importation of billfish into the United States. And proponents of the bill noted that billfish stocks globally, as they reported, have been depleted, and that the United States is a major market for foreign caught billfish. And so, I guess the objective of the measure was to support conservation. However, it was recognized by Congress and President Obama that there are traditional fisheries in the Pacific and fisheries where marlin stocks are much more in healthy condition than, say, in the Atlantic. And there was an exemption provided for Hawaii fisheries that catch billfish and also Guam, American Samoa, and the Northern Mariana Islands. A billfish could be sold into the United States market.
But that is about to change. President Trump just signed a bill eliminating the exemption given to Hawaii and U.S. Pacific territories. Now, billfish caught in those waters can only be sold where they were caught. That may benefit Hawaii consumers in the form of lower prices, but will hurt local seafood distributors.
On average, there's around 550,000 pounds of billfish sold annually in U.S. markets caught by Hawaii fisheries. So that has a dockside value of nearly $1 million. And when you multiply that out into the retail market, it's a couple million to $3 million. So it's a loss of market. You might have more billfish supply here locally, which might drive the price down here in Hawaii prices for Hawaii fishermen. So there's going to be an impact.
It also means that mainland restaurants and consumers will lose their last legal source of commercially caught billfish. According to Caleb McMahon with the local distributor Hawaiian Fresh Seafood, that fish sometimes fills a critical role.
Let's take this last week, for example. The tuna situation has been brutal. And I don't think that Hawaiian Fresh Seafood is alone in experiencing that. I think everyone has been really hurting. A lot of chefs and restaurants, across the country and certainly locally have been stressing to get their hands on tuna. In times like that, when you have, from our perspective, from a trying to keep customers, trying to keep a relationship going with a restaurant or a chef. If we can't give them tuna, it sometimes it's nice to be able to offer something else. Let's say I've got this chef in Portland, Oregon, and he's got this high-end sushi gig, and he's buying 50 pounds of my best tuna every week, my number one grade tuna. last week, for example, and it's been tough. It's been tough. Last week kind of reached a crescendo of toughness. Last week, I couldn't send that guy anything, any tuna. And he says, well, geez, Caleb, what can I do? And I say, geez, you know what? You got to call my competitor. You got to call the other guy. And he calls that guy, and he doesn't have the rapport there, and they can't help him either because the tuna situation's tough all over. So what do you do? Hey, chef, I've got this nice piece of nairagi that I can send you. You can do sashimi with it. You can put it on your rolls. You can sear it. Sometimes that can be the difference between keeping a customer and losing a customer.
Florida Democratic Congressman Darren Soto sponsored the original bill eliminating Hawaii's exemption, saying it, quote, strikes a balance between preserving traditional cultural fishing in these areas and the overall intent to prevent large-scale commercial fishing of these billfish. According to Westpac, billfish stocks in the U.S. Pacific waters are already being sustainably managed in line with international standards. NOAA's Pacific Fisheries Office declined to comment on the matter, but the agency's assistant manager for fisheries was quoted in December as saying he had full confidence in the existing billfish management practices. All that has Michael Lee of Garden and Valley Isle Seafood scratching his head.
When you look at global catch of marlin, the United States catch is only about 1%. And really, that's aside from some recreational fishing going on both the West Coast and East Coast, which is very highly regulated. Most of that catch comes out of Hawaii. So when you're looking at the big scope of things, they're putting all this economic hardship on the people, on the fishermen of Hawaii and the businesses of Hawaii for 1% take in the global catch. No sustainability or no scientific data to substantiate it that would help improve the fishery. So it makes you wonder what's behind it.
Another problem with the new rules is that billfish are what is known as bycatch. They get caught by accident while trolling for other species. That means there isn't much commercial fishing boats can do to avoid them. Local seafood distributors don't expect to catch fewer billfish as a result of the new law, but they do expect the price of billfish in Hawaii to drop. Lower prices mean lower profit margins, and that may result in dead billfish bycatch being thrown out at sea instead of being sold at market. Local distributor Caleb McMahon.
We're looking at a death by a thousand cuts situation. The Billfish Act Amendment isn't going to ruin the Hawaii longline fishery, even though it's going to sting. But this is another in a long succession of initiatives that I feel like are well-intentioned conservation initiatives, but they're falling flat on their face in terms of achieving their objectives. I mean, it's getting harder and harder to participate in this fishery. You know, the seafood industry as a whole, the profit margins are slim, and it's fishing. You know, at the end of the day, it's called fishing, not catching.
For The Conversation, I'm Ryan Finnerty.
You can find links to more information about billfish in Hawaii at The Conversation Podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. On this National S'mores Day, we wanted to test your knowledge of a local graham cracker manufacturer. Diamond Bakery has been open for over 90 years and remains one of Hawaii's favorite bakeries. In 2009, Diamond Bakery filled a much-needed niche, selling sea biscuits, what most locals know as Ceylon pilot crackers, along with the continental East Coast. They now have international reach, selling their product to Japan and across the Pacific. But the company had a lot of help from a baker that helped them kick their feet off the ground to become one of Hawaii's most recognized brands. Sam Dunphy joined the team in 1937 from the mainland and helped to expand their production. That's today's quiz, and today's winner from Kihei was Christy Ellison. Congrats to you. And if you have an idea for a quiz that you'd like to share with us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Some summer's winding down, and there's still time to kick off a few titles from that reading list that just seems to get longer and longer. Or perhaps you're one of those who don't have a list but love getting lost in a book. To help our readers discover new titles to add to their reading list, The Conversation's Lillian Tseng sat down with longtime HPR volunteer and WANA librarian Cheryl Lynch to talk about their favorite subject, books.
Hey, Cheryl. Welcome to The Conversation.
Thanks, Lillian. It's fun to be here.
Well, let's start off with what makes you pick up a book?
They say don't judge a book by its cover, but I absolutely judge a book by its cover. So if it looks good, or I know the author, the title is really important because it intrigues you. And if it intrigues you, if you like the artwork on the cover, if you don't, you won't look at it, you know? So publishers spend a lot of money and effort on the cover, so it does matter.
You're purchasing titles for your branch library, aren't you?
Yes.
What goes into that?
Well, we get a central list. So the selectors, they do a lot of homework and put books on the list. There's always the popular authors, because the library system has hot picks. So they'll buy a lot of the popular titles. So I don't have to do that, which is really nice. You look and see what Oprah suggests. You look and see, you know, what your patrons are asking for. We get a lot of good suggestions from patrons. Mm. And, you know, there's a lot of resources, like both online and, you know, magazine reviews and all kinds.
Mm. Sounds like inspiration is there all around. You just never know when a title will come to you.
Yeah. Mm. But I was thinking about why I like to read. I think it's because it's such an individual experience. You get to pick who you visit. You get to pick what subject. You get to pick everything. But there is community in reading, too. You know, whether it's a book club or you're talking to the person next to you about what they're reading, or I come and see you. First thing we talk about is, what are we reading? There's a lot of community in reading, so it's got such a broad way to approach it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned book club.
Mm-hmm.
How many are you in?
Right now, just two. Our library has one, mm-hmm. and I have a personal book club with just that's composed of some friends, and they come and go, and we're pretty loosey-goosey, you know. But the thing about reading in book club is it often puts you in a place to read something you would never read. Like, I'm a kind of a dedicated fiction reader, but we read the nonfiction book, The Soul of an Octopus. The author falls in love with some octopus at the aquarium, I think in Boston. And it was charming, plus full of facts. And the other people that were working at the aquarium, you get to meet all them too. And they were really odd, quirky, interesting bunch of people. And everybody in book club was mesmerized by it. And none of us would have read it. And we all really appreciated it. We all kind of changed our diet too. None of us will eat taco anymore.
So the beauty of books is really they are able to take you outside of where we are, get to visit and learn so much new things. Mm-hmm. Is it hard to start a book club?
No, actually, it's pretty easy. You just have to make some basic decisions when you start. Some parameters, like how you're going to discuss it. You know, is it going to be round robin? How you're going to pick the books, and making it, what is the word, making it equitable so everybody gets to have some input. Mm-hmm. And you might not like the book the person picked, but you kind of feel an obligation to read it so that you can see what they saw in it and contribute to the conversation. The conversation about it at book club is really fun.
Mm-hmm. It's like book club allows you to take reading to another level and engage with other readers. There are just so many books. What is your favorite genre of, I guess, fiction? What are you reading?
I have decided that I'm now interested in mysteries. So the story is a mystery because you don't know where it's going.
So as you've been exploring the mystery genre, any discoveries or what's under the radar? Who do you think is a really great writer, great title that people should know more about?
Well, I have started reading Inspector Sean Duffy, Adrian McKinty's series about the only Catholic detective on the Northern Ireland police force. And they're set during the Troubles in Ireland. So those are great. I do have a crush on him. Oh, and my other favorite is Colin Cottrell's series about Siri Pyboon. It's a national coroner of Laos in the 70s, and he's a communist, but only because he needs to be. That's a great series. You learn a lot about the Laotian people, and the first book in that series is The Coroner's Lunch.
Well, how about locally? Any local authors you would recommend?
Oh, my. Speaking of mystery, the Victoria Newbles series, Murder Leaves Its Mark and Murder Casts a Shadow. Those are set in Hawaii in the 20s. And the two main characters are Nina Beckworth. She has a twin. And another character who's a part Samoan playwright. And they solve mysteries together. It's a romance. You learn a lot of Hawaiian history. And let's see what other local ones I really like. Oh, of course, Lee Cataluna. We love her. 3 years on Doreen's Sofa. That is really a unique book. Maybe not for everybody, but we read that in book club, and that was also a really good discussion because there was so many different opinions about it. And then she came to our book club and talked to us. Oh, my.
That's
Everybody
exciting.
Loved that, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was very, we had a huge turnout, so that was really fun, yeah.
Thank you, Cheryl.
You're welcome.
I definitely have a lot of new reads added to my list, but before you go, any final thoughts?
No, just if you don't like something that you're reading, there's so many things out there. Give it a little try. Maybe give it 50 pages. And if I don't want to keep going, go back to the library and get something else, or two or three.
That was public librarian Cheryl Lynch speaking with The Conversation's Lillian Song. Cheryl's been helping patrons for the past 18 years, and you can look for the titles mentioned through the Libraries Hawaii app at libraries.hawaii.org. You can also learn more about the ongoing book clubs held throughout the state. And do you have a favorite author or series? In 60 seconds or less, tell us what's at the top of your reading list. Call our talkback line at 792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
New music from an old soul. That's Oahu-born soul singer and guitarist Nick Kurosawa. There'll be nothing between you and this bright young talent in HPR's Atherton Studio on Saturday the 18th. Reserve your seats today at hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Folks say that you...
That's it for this week. Coming up next week, recaps from the primary election. If you're happy or unhappy with the results, we'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. And if you want to hear today's show again, go to the conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. The program's produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Cotton-Bruceby. And a big mahalo to John DeMello for our backyard theme. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday and pick up the conversation.